whereas Federal Reserve just sort of waves a magic wand and the money appears, but then they lend it to the federal government by buying treasury bonds. And ultimately, that's what dollars are. They are issued by the Federal Reserve, and they're circulating government debt. Now, much of that nowadays is held overseas, and people talk about, well, we have this terrible debt. We kind of imagine it's all owed to China. In fact, China has only got on the game very recently. They're playing an interesting game, but in a way, it's rather secondary. For most of our history, the countries that held U.S. Treasury bonds were, well, West Germany was the big one during the Cold War, but also Japan. Japan still does. South Korea, the Gulf states. What do all these countries have in common? Well, they all have American military bases. They're all under American military protection. Essentially, the U.S. Army sits across the world. If you calculate it, the rise of the deficit corresponds almost exactly with the rise of military spending. And much of that new borrowing is from overseas, but it's from exactly the people who the Army is sitting on top of. And the Treasury bonds are constantly rolled over. Every time they mature, rather than actually asking for the money back, they simply buy new Treasury bonds with it. So since they pay less than the rate of inflation, it's kind of a negative. People have described it as a tax. You could almost describe it as an imperial tribute system.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because much has been made on the left, as well as the right, about the U.S. being this debtor to these countries and its bonds being held by these overseas institutional investors. And on the left, it's been seen by some as an indicator that the U.S. as an empire is fundamentally weak. But could its debts, in fact, actually reflect its power?
Well, I think so. I mean, you know, it's protection money. Now, you can think of it in two senses. You can think of it as protection money in the mafia sense. You know, if you're Japan, the fact that the U.S., you know, owes you money basically is a shakedown system because, you know, the U.S. isn't going to pay, and how are you going to make them pay? They have their giant army sitting on your country. Or you can think of it as protection money in a more literal sense that, you know, they're hiring us as mercenaries to protect them against China or whatever other country they're worried about right now. It's a little bit of both. But, you know, you could easily make the argument that this is exactly how the empire works. We have an empire that doesn't claim to be an empire. I mean, any other time in history where you have a country with giant military bases all over many other countries, that has been referred to as an empire. We don't like to refer to it as an empire, but if we don't like to refer to it as an empire, obviously we're not going to refer to the money they seem to be giving us as tribute. So we call it debt.
Well, and as you mentioned a bit earlier, a pivotal moment in all of this seems to have been in August of 1971, when Richard Nixon decided to take the U.S. dollar off the gold standard in order to pay for the Vietnam War. Before then, a dollar was pegged to the price of gold. And then since then, the U.S. has, it seems to have ushered in a really new era in terms of the financialization of the economy, and yet the dollar has stayed central as the reserve currency, perhaps because of its imperial role.
Precisely. I mean, if you look at what the sort of world currency is at any given historical period for the last 300-400 years, it has been the currency of the primary military power. I don't think that's a coincidence. Now, in the case of Nixon, it's really quite interesting. The dollar was redeemable overseas, not in America itself, which actually shows the role of taxes, right? Because they can, if only dollars are usable in taxes, they don't really have to have anything to underpin the dollar in the country. However, overseas, the fact that only dollars can be used as taxes in the U.S. is insignificant. So they said, all right, overseas you can redeem the dollar for $35 an ounce in gold. Problem was that at one point, both England and France started calling the U.S. on the debt, asking to redeem a lot of the dollars. At one point, apparently, the floor of the Bank of England collapsed under the weight of the gold they were getting from America. Once France actually started demanding the gold, it became a prospect of having to empty out Burt Knox. A lot of that, they were just trying to play around with various rooms under the Federal Reserve Building in New York, where they have these chambers where all these central banks have their gold reserves, and if there's an imbalance, they just move it from one room to another. Now, at one point, Charles de Gaulle said, no, this will not do. Give us the actual gold. And his successor, Pompidou, actually sent a battleship to New York Harbor in 71 saying, look, take the gold, put it in the ship, and send it to us. Nixon simply said, no, what are you going to do, nuke us? Which is, of course, the same thing with China now. I mean, in theory, the U.S. owes all this money to China, whatever that actually means. If China really tried to recall in any way that would upset the international financial order, you know, the U.S. would just do exactly the same thing. We don't really have to do anything we don't want to. It's not like China's going to send nuclear bombs to the U.S. over something like that. However, the paradoxical result of Nixon going off the gold standard was that instead of using gold as the ultimate reserve currency, banks started actually using treasury bonds. So it actually reinforced the American empire, imperial system. Now, that's the thing that's only now really being seriously challenged.
You write in Debt that throughout history, in periods where virtual money has dominated, and you would place us now in such a period, that during those times, institutions would be produced that would protect debtors so that the lenders and the powerful couldn't conspire to just exploit debtors to the maximum. But what we're seeing now is something quite different, which is that lenders through, you know, institutions like the International Monetary Fund can absolutely push debtors to the limit, whether it's imposing structural adjustment on the global south or through other mechanisms to basically just have their way entirely. So I wanted to ask you, looking back, how did those institutions that did protect debtors actually appear historically? Because the question you pose is, why did that happen in the past and is not happening now? But what were the forces that actually engendered these institutions in the first place? Were they set up by the rich and powerful? I mean, it seems sort of hard to imagine.
It's a really interesting question. And of course, one of the problems we have in history is that the voices of the people we now consider social movements are very hard to find. They're not the sort of things likely to be written down on a cuneiform tablet, you know. If a king did sort of bow down to popular pressure, kicking and screaming and make concessions to social movements, he wouldn't write that. He would write, you know, I, the great king, you know, owing to my benevolence toward the widows and orphans of my land, decided, you know, to do X. So we don't really know what the politics of the day was like. But, for example, in Mesopotamia, we get a sense of what happened. There were periodic debt crises. People would fall into debt. Say there was a bad harvest. Farmers would have to borrow grain. They would get trapped in debt traps. It became part classic phenomenon. It becomes harder and harder to get out. You start having to pawn your fields, your flocks. People start repossessing things. Of course, the more they repossess, the harder it is for you to make the additional payments. Eventually, you start losing everything. People would lose their children. It would become sometimes enslaved, sometimes debt peons, their wives, sometimes themselves. These debt crises would threaten to destroy society because people started resisting. And the most common mode of resistance in much of the ancient world was simply running away. It took a lot longer to run away. If you're, you know, a shifting cultivator, you just sort of run instantly. That's why it's very hard to create a state. Where there's irrigation networks and people have put a lot of investment, you know, people won't run away until they're really hard-pressed. But eventually they will. If they leave the irrigated area, they'll join nomad bands. Social order will start falling into chaos. And kings would panic. Sometimes they would panic simply because there's nobody to serve in their armies anymore. Sometimes they would panic because they see everything falling apart, and they would declare periodic debt forgiveness. It often became the case in certain periods of Mesopotamian history that every king, the first thing they would do when they took power would be to declare a clean slate. All debts were forgiven. Sometimes debts in silver, commercial debts weren't forgiven, but debts in grain, consumer debt was. All debts were forgiven, and everybody gets to go home. I like to quote the Sumerian word amargi, to the first recorded word for freedom in any human language as a word for debt freedom. And it literally means return to mother, because all of the people who've been sort of taken off to serve in the households of the rich got to go home. Now, that became institutionalized as the Jubilee through the prophets, so again, with the sort of voice of the angry poor in ancient Judea. And similar things happened in the ancient world, often very explicitly revolutionary movements. The sort of great program throughout, Moses Finley, the great classicist, once said that there's basically one revolutionary program in all of antiquity, which was cancel the debts and redistribute the land. So there was intense pressure from below to cancel debts all the time. As I say, the great religions, Buddhism, Christianity, Islam, really start in a certain way as social movements and are caught up in anti-war movements. Confucianism was the same thing. Now, in almost every case, as soon as those religions become the sort of arbiters of economic life, first thing they do again is to put controls over debt traps, usually by eliminating usury. It was the most common one. The Buddhists were slightly different. They didn't actually object to lending money at interest. Instead, they created alternative institutions so that the first widespread use of pawn shops actually comes out of medieval China. They were almost invariably in Buddhist monasteries as a way to provide an alternative to the local loan shark. The Confucians, who ran the governments and were somewhat suspicious of the Buddhists also, would do periodic debt cancellation. Now, in almost every case, it's because governments were suspicious of the mercantile classes, and but also because having a prosperous peasantry was critically important to them to keep the taxes coming in.
So perhaps it's too early to make a judgment about what's happening now, given that, you know, in historical time, being, say, 30 to 40 years into this new era is really, way too soon. But
40 years is nothing if you're talking about 500-year cycles.
Exactly. And yet, you write in debt that this notion that there's a moral obligation that we all have to pay off our debts has been particularly pronounced in the United States.
Yeah.
And, you know, very much part of this country's culture. And yet, of course, the global financial crisis has, in some ways, you know, maybe only partially, but it's helped shift in some ways the ways that we see debt. And I wonder if you think that the time is really ripe for some kind of mass resistance against debt, whether it's, you know, coordinated refusal for students, for example, to pay their debts, given that student debt now eclipses credit card debt as the largest individual debt in the United States, or, you know, on a level of countries like Greece, you know, what if they decided to default? I mean, do you think that this is actually something that radicals should be taking up and encouraging?
Absolutely. I mean, it has to happen. And even the capitalist class is coming to realize that the existing order is just not viable. It's not going to work. In a way, we've been dealing with a series of continual debt crises since the 70s. At first, it was mainly concentrated in the Third World, which is, after all, where most people in the world do live. But nonetheless, they managed to keep it kind of apart from people in North Atlantic countries, the wealthier countries. But as soon as that really ended, and ultimately, really, the global justice movement effectively won. IMF, structural adjustment, all of that was kicked out of East Asia. It was kicked out of Latin America. Most countries in the world don't deal with the IMF anymore and are, incidentally, not undergoing austerity right now. Effectively, what they did was they took those horrific policies and they reapplied them at home to Europe and America. Now, it's not viable. And historically, as I say, people have really been doing things almost exactly backwards. When you have a period of virtual credit money, what that means, it doesn't just mean that people are using immaterial means to make promises, financial promises to one another. It means that people come to understand that money isn't actually a thing. Money is a social relationship. It's nothing but a promise, an arrangement, an IOU, and arrangements can be rearranged, and in a sense, invariably have to be. In a way, that sacred nature of debt is always something that really only applies between the rich and the poor. You know, poor people are constantly bailing people out, giving people gifts, which they dress up as loans, but really they're not. If you send money to your brother, it's really often a way of sending saving face because he won't take a gift from you. Rich people, you know, that debt between two rich people is not the same between the debt that a poor person is to a rich person, and this has always been true in world history. If it's important players, they can work something out. I mean, sometimes they play games with each other and try to destroy each other, like Goldman Sachs did to Lehman Brothers. But, you know, ultimately, rich people can be extraordinarily generous and forgiving when dealing with each other. It's just with everybody else that debt becomes a sacred thing that, of course, has to be paid. Now, what we learned in 2008 was exactly that, that, if, you know, virtual money is different. You can rearrange things. In fact, they made trillions of dollars of debts of the big players, people like AIG, vanish overnight through various forms of financial mumbo-jumbo. They could have done the same thing to ordinary mortgages. In fact, the irony is, if they had actually bailed out everybody, everybody's mortgage, that itself would have bailed out the banks. But they wanted to keep up that idea of the sacredness of debt between poor people and the financial elite, which should be increasingly became identical with the capitalist class themselves, since just about all capitalist firms were going into the financial business in one way or another. Now, I think that the movements we see around the world now are essentially saying, look, the cat is out of the bag. We understand what's going on now. We understand that markets don't really run themselves. We understand that debts don't really have to be repaid. If you're a big enough player, too big to fail, then something will always be worked out. But if the debt is now just a social arrangement or a political arrangement, well, if democracy is going to mean anything, it's going to has to mean that everybody has to weigh in on how this happens, how these promises are made, and how they can be renegotiated, since they actually are renegotiated all the time. That's what I think is going on in Greece and Spain, where you have these vast social movements around real democracy and focusing on the debt again. But take the example of Egypt. A lot of what happened in Egypt had to do with microcredit and debt. The reaction by Saudi Arabia is very telling. When they were afraid that the revolution was going to spread there, one of the first things they did, aside from beef up security forces, was to declare a jubilee of their own. They actually did universal debt forgiveness. And one of the first things the new Egyptian government did was to tell the IMF to go away. There is a huge amount of mobilization around this, and I think it's a point where capitalism has really revealed itself to be extremely weak. It no longer can maintain the illusion that this is a system that runs itself. That division between market and state has essentially vanished. We realize that we're facing a sort of uniform enemy here. And I think it's almost inevitable that social movements begin to take advantage of this remarkable weakness of the other side.
Well, I'd like to end by just asking you about perhaps one of the more hopeful dimensions, although what you've just said is quite hopeful as well, in looking at debt that you pose in your book, which is that although our societies are very much structured around debt, the way we interact with each other on a daily constant basis actually tends to be, rather than capitalistic, communist.
Yeah. Communism is the basis of all sociability. Obviously, in order to say that, you have to have a slightly different definition of communism than that largely thrown out. But let's call it small-c communism. One of the reasons why we imagine all moral relations as debts is because we think of all transactions, all relations we have with one another, certainly all economic relations which involve transferring some kind of good or labor back and forth, as if there are matters of exchange. And economics teaches us to do this. But it becomes a habit. I mean, even those people who are arguing against economists, the sociologists, will often say, well, no, it is an exchange, but it's a moral exchange. It's not a self-interested exchange. But a lot of what we do with each other isn't exchange at all. And I really think it's important that we sort of take the blinkers off our eyes and look around at how we actually live our lives. Gibson Graham, for example, a feminist economist, long since pointed out that, capitalism isn't the way we live most of the time. Most actions we do aren't profit-oriented. We just tend to have ways that we don't think about, most of what we do every day, which has nothing to do with capitalism. And I, try to take that a little more systematically, and I pointed out that, there is actual exchange. It can take the form of gift exchange, or it can take the form of commodity buying and selling. You have hierarchical relations, which are not reciprocal at all. If you give something to a superior and inferior, often it's just taken to mean you're expected to do it again. But you also have communistic relations, and in a way, communistic relations are the most fundamental, because all other relations are built on them. By communistic relations, I mean very simply, from each according to their ability, to each according to their needs. In fact, when people are cooperating with one another, it doesn't matter where. If you're working for ExxonMobil or for DuPont or whatever name your evil capitalist corporation, if I say, hey, hand me the wrench, the other guy doesn't say, yeah, what do I get? You allocate resources in terms of who needs it and who actually can do what they can do. So communism, in a sense, is the essence of all forms of cooperation, but it's also the essence of all forms of sociability. I mean, if there's someone that I don't, isn't my enemy, who I'm not actively opposed to, well, there is an assumption that on some basic level, of course, we will behave on the basis of from each according to their abilities to each according to their needs. That is, if the need is great enough, I'm drowning, throw me a life preserver, or the cost is small enough, directions, do you have a light? Well, of course we're going to do that. We're not going to keep account. And in those relations which are most important to us, which are characterized by love and actual caring, well, we do the same thing. We take into consideration each other's needs. We take into each other's abilities, but we don't actually keep account of who gave what to whom. And one reason we do that is because we assume that those relationships are going to be around forever. Your best friend will always be your best friend. You don't have to keep track of who's done who a favor. Your mother, your mother's not always going to be there, but imagine relations like that as if they are eternal. They're always going to be there. Society itself is always going to be there, so you don't have to keep track of how many people have held doors for you and how many you've held doors for. So in that sense, almost all relations are founded on this assumption of communism. And in many societies, incidentally, you know, that idea of, like, you know, give me a light, extends to much more important things. There are many parts of the world that if you ask someone for some food, you basically can't refuse. I always like the story, there's this Maori story from New Zealand about this guy named Te Renga, who, it's probably apocryphal, but used to go around every day and, like, go by the beach and watch people fishing. And when he came back, he would say, wow, you got some squid? Wow, I love squid, you know. And, of course, they'd have to give it to him. He used to do this every day and drove everybody crazy. So after about 5 years, they killed him. Because you can't actually say, no, I'm not going to give you the squid. So in a sense, we're all communists. We're all already communists. And to me, rather than thinking of capitalism and communism as two counterposed principles, I think capitalism is simply a really bad way of organizing communism. Communism will always be here. What we need to do is to figure out ways to organize communism that will not make it turn into social hierarchies.
And for the new listeners to the show, I should point out that the whole of Debt, the First 5,000 Years was read on the show as an audiobook. If you go to our website, you can download it. Now, searching for a suitably optimistic note on which to end this show, we conclude with the last chapter of Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States, read for us by Matthew Slater.
Chapter 21, The Coming Revolt of the Guards. The title of this chapter is not a prediction, but a hope, which I will soon explain. As for the title of this book, it is not quite accurate. A people's history promises more than any one person can fulfill, and it is the most difficult kind of history to recapture. I call it that anyway because, with all its limitations, it is a history disrespectful of governments and respectful of people's movements of resistance. That makes it a biased account, one that leans in a certain direction. I'm not troubled by that because the mountain of history books under which we all stand leans so heavily in the other direction, so tremblingly respectful of states and statesmen, and so disrespectful, by inattention, to people's movements, that we need some counterforce to avoid being crushed into submission. All those histories of this country centered on the founding fathers and the presidents weigh oppressively on the capacity of the ordinary citizen to act. They suggest that in times of crisis we must look to someone to save us. In the revolutionary crisis, the founding fathers. In the slavery crisis, Lincoln. In the depression, Roosevelt. In the Vietnam Watergate crisis, Carter. And that between occasional crises, everything is all right, and it's sufficient for us to be restored to that normal state. They teach us that the supreme act of citizenship is to choose among saviors, by going into a voting booth every 4 years to choose between two white and well-off Anglo-Saxon males of inoffensive personality and orthodox opinions. The idea of saviors has been built into the entire culture, beyond politics. We have learned to look to stars, leaders, experts in every field, thus surrendering our own strength, demeaning our own ability, obliterating our own selves. But from time to time, Americans reject that idea and rebel. These rebellions so far have been contained. The American system is the most ingenious system of control in world history. With a country so rich in natural resources, talent, and labor power, the system can afford to distribute just enough wealth to just enough people to limit discontent to a troublesome minority. It is a country so powerful, so big, so pleasing to so many of its citizens that it can afford to give freedom of dissent to the small number that are not pleased. There is no system of control with more openings, apertures, leeways, flexibilities, rewards for the chosen, winning tickets in lotteries. There is none that disperses its controls more complexly through the voting system, the work situation, the church, the family, the school, the mass media, and none more successful in mollifying opposition with reforms, isolating people from one another, creating patriotic loyalty. 1% of the nation owns a third of the wealth. The rest of the wealth is distributed in such a way as to turn those in the 99% against one another. Small property owners against the propertyless, black against white, native-born against foreign-born, intellectuals and professionals against the uneducated and unskilled. These groups have resented one another and warred against one another with such vehemence and violence as to obscure their common position as sharers of leftovers in a very wealthy country. Against the reality of that desperate, bitter battle for resources made scarce by elite control, I'm taking the liberty of uniting those 99% as the people. I have been writing a history that attempts to represent their submerged, deflected common interest, to emphasize the commonality of the 99%. To declare deep enmity of interest with the 1% is to do exactly what the governments of the United States and the wealthy elite allied to them from the Founding Fathers to now have tried their best to prevent. Madison feared a majority faction and hoped the new Constitution would control it. He and his colleagues began the preamble to the Constitution with the words, "We the people," pretending that the new government stood for everyone, and hoping that this myth, accepted as a fact, would ensure domestic tranquility. The pretense continued over the generations, helped by all-embracing symbols, physical or verbal, the flag, patriotism, democracy, national interest, national defense, national security. The slogans were dug into the earth of American culture like a circle of covered wagons on the western plain, from inside of which the white, slightly privileged American could shoot to kill the enemy outside, Indians or blacks or foreigners or other whites too wretched to be allowed inside the circle. The managers of the caravan watched at a safe distance, and when the battle was over and the field strewn with the dead on both sides, they would take over the land and prepare another expedition for another territory. The scheme never worked perfectly. The Revolution and the Constitution, trying to bring stability by containing the class angers of the colonial period while enslaving blacks, annihilating or displacing Indians, did not quite succeed, judging by the tenant uprisings, the slave revolts, the abolitionist agitation, the feminist upsurge, the Indian guerrilla warfare of the pre-Civil War years. After the Civil War, a new coalition of southern and northern elites developed, with southern whites and blacks of the lower classes occupied in racial conflict, native workers and immigrant workers clashing in the north, and the farmers dispersed over a big country, while the system of capitalism consolidated itself in industry and government. But there came rebellion among industrial workers and a great opposition movement among farmers. At the turn of the century, the violent pacification of blacks and Indians and the use of elections and war to absorb and divert white rebels were not enough, in the conditions of modern industry, to prevent the great upsurge of socialism, the massive labour struggles before the First World War. Neither that war, nor the partial prosperity of the 20s, nor the apparent destruction of the socialist movement, could prevent, in the situation of economic crisis, another radical awakening, another labour upsurge in the 30s. World War II created a new unity, followed by an apparently successful attempt, in the atmosphere of the Cold War, to extinguish the strong radical temper of the war years. But then, surprisingly, came the surge of the 60s, from people thought long subdued or put out of sight, blacks, women, Native Americans, prisoners, soldiers, and a new radicalism, which threatened to spread widely in a population disillusioned by the Vietnam War and the politics of Watergate. The exile of Nixon, the celebration of the bicentennial, the presidency of Carter, all aimed at restoration. But though the great tide of the 60s had receded, it left on the beach millions of moving organisms, pockets of energy, in an atmosphere calmed down, but electric with possibility. In this uncertain situation of the 70s going into the 80s, it's very important for the establishment, that uneasy club of business executives, generals, and politicos, to maintain the historic pretension of national unity, in which the government represents all the people, and the common enemy is overseas, not at home, where the disasters of economics or war are unfortunate errors or tragic accidents to be corrected by members of the same club that brought the disasters. It's important also to make sure this artificial unity of highly privileged and slightly privileged is the only unity, that the 99% remain split in countless ways and turn against one another to vent their angers. How skilful to tax the middle class to pay for the relief of the poor, building resentment on top of humiliation. How adroit to bus poor black youngsters into poor white neighbourhoods in a violent exchange of impoverished schools, while the schools of the rich remain untouched and the wealth of the nation, doled out carefully where children need free milk, is drained for billion-dollar aircraft carriers. How ingenious to meet the demands of blacks and women for equality by giving them small special benefits and setting them in competition with everyone else for jobs made scarce by an irrational, wasteful system. How wise to turn the fear and anger of the majority towards a class of criminals bred by economic equality, but with all the controls of power and punishment, enticements and concessions, diversions and decoys, operating throughout the history of the country, the establishment has been unable to keep itself secure from revolt. Every time it looked as if it had succeeded, the very people it thought seduced or subdued stirred and rose. Blacks, cajoled by Supreme Court decisions and congressional statutes, rebelled. Women, wooed and ignored, romanticized and mistreated, rebelled. Indians, thought dead, reappeared defiant. Young people, despite lures of career and comfort, defected. Working people, thought soothed by reforms regulated by law, kept within bounds by their own unions, went on strike. Government intellectuals pledged to secrecy began giving away secrets. Priests turned from piety to protests. Prisoners, isolated in cages, organized. To recall this is to remind people of what the establishment would like them to forget. The enormous capacity of apparently helpless people to resist, of apparently contented people to demand change. To uncover such history is to find a powerful human impulse to assert one's humanity. It is to hold out, even in times of deep pessimism, the possibility of surprise. True, to overestimate class consciousness, to exaggerate rebellion and its successes, would be misleading. It would not account for the fact that the world, not just the United States, but everywhere else, is still in the hands of the elites, that people's movements, although they show an infinite capacity for recurrence, have so far been either defeated or absorbed or perverted, that socialist revolutionists have betrayed socialism, that nationalist revolutions have led to new dictatorships. But most histories understate revolt, overemphasize statesmanship, and thus encourage impotency amongst citizens. When we look closely at resistance movements, or even at isolated forms of rebellion, we discover that class consciousness, or any other awareness of injustice, has multiple levels. It has many ways of expression, many ways of revealing itself, open, subtle, direct, distorted. In a system of intimidation and control, people do not show how much they know, how deeply they feel, until their practical sense informs them they can do so without being destroyed. History which keeps alive the memory of people's resistance suggests new definitions of power. By traditional definitions, whoever possesses military strength, wealth, command of official ideology, cultural control, has power. Measured by these standards, popular rebellion never looks strong enough to survive. However, the unexpected victories, even temporary ones, of insurgents show the vulnerability of the supposedly powerful. In a highly developed society, the establishment cannot survive without the obedience and loyalty of millions of people who are given small rewards to keep the system going. The soldiers and police, the teachers and ministers, administrators and social workers, technicians and production workers, doctors, lawyers, nurses, transport and communications workers, garbage men and firemen. These people, the employed, the somewhat privileged, are drawn into alliance with the elite. They become the guards of the system, buffers between the upper and lower classes. If they stop obeying, the system falls. That will happen, I think, only when all of us who are slightly privileged and slightly uneasy begin to see that we are like the guards in the prison uprising at Attica, expendable, that the establishment, whatever rewards it gives us, will also, if necessary to maintain its control, kill us. Certain new facts may, in our time, emerge so clearly as to lead to general withdrawal of loyalty from the system. The new conditions of technology, economics, and war in the atomic age make it less and less possible for the guards of the system, the intellectuals, the homeowners, the taxpayers, the skilled workers, the professionals, the servants of government, to remain immune from the violence, physical and psychic, inflicted on the black, the poor, the criminal, the enemy overseas. All of us have become hostages in the new conditions of doomsday technology, runaway economics, global poisoning, uncontainable war. The atomic weapons, the invisible radiation, the economic anarchy do not distinguish prisoners from guards, and those in charge will not be scrupulous in making distinctions. There is the unforgettable response of the U.S. High Command to the news that American prisoners of war might be near Nagasaki. Targets previously assigned for centerboard remain unchanged. There is evidence of growing dissatisfaction among the guards. It has been shown in the early 1960s that the poor and ignored were the non-voters, alienated from a political system they felt didn't care about them and about which they could do little. In the mid-70s, another study found that alienation had spread upward into the families above the poverty line. These are white workers, neither rich nor poor, but angry over economic insecurity, unhappy with their work, worried about their neighborhoods, hostile to government, combining elements of racism with elements of class consciousness, contempt for the lower classes along with distrust for the elite, and thus open to solutions from any direction, right or left. In the 20s there was a similar estrangement in the middle classes, which could have gone in various directions. The Ku Klux Klan had millions of members at the time, but the work of an organized left wing mobilized a huge amount of this feeling into trade unions, farmers' unions, socialist movements. We may in the next decade be in a race for the mobilization of middle-class discontent. The fact of that discontent is clear. When the surveys of the early 70s showed 70% and 80% of Americans distrustful of government, the business, military, it meant that this feeling went beyond the blacks, the poor, the radicals. It had spread among skilled workers, white-collar workers, professionals. For the first time in the nation's history, perhaps both the lower classes and the middle classes, the prisoners and the guards, were disillusioned with the system. There are other signs. The high rate of alcoholism, the high rate of divorce, from one of three marriages ending in divorce, the figure was climbing to one of two, of drug use and abuse, of nervous breakdowns and mental illness. Millions of people have been looking desperately for solutions to their sense of impotency, their loneliness, their frustration, their estrangement from other people, from the world, from their work, from themselves. They have been adopting new religions, joining self-help groups of all kinds. It is as if a whole nation were going through a critical point in its middle age, a life crisis of self-doubt, self-examination. All this at a time when the middle class is increasingly insecure economically. The system, in its irrationality, has been driven by profit to build steel skyscrapers for insurance companies while the cities decay, to spend billions for weapons of destruction and virtually nothing for children's playgrounds, to give huge incomes to men who make dangerous or useless things, and very little to artists, musicians, writers, actors. Capitalism has always been a failure for the lower classes. It is now beginning to fail for the middle classes. The threat of unemployment, always inside the homes of the poor, has spread to white-collar workers, professionals. A college education is no longer a guarantee against joblessness, and a system that cannot offer a future to the young coming out of school is in deep trouble. If it happens only to the children of the poor, the problem is manageable. There are jails. If it happens to the children of the middle class, things may get out of hand. The poor are accustomed to being squeezed and always short of money, but in recent years the middle classes too have begun to feel the press of high prices, high taxes. In the mid-70s, the property of the average homeowner in Boston was assessed at around 32% of its value, while downtown the National Shawmut Bank of Boston was assessed at 6.9% of its value, the First National Bank building at 8.7%. A new group called Fair Share was calling attention to this. A new publication called Dollars and Cents was printing the figures. Would taxpayers, whose anger had always been shunted onto welfare recipients, begin to see that their incomes were being dismembered to subsidize welfare payments for the rich? In the 60s and 70s, there was a dramatic, frightening increase in the number of crimes. It was not hard to understand when one walked through any big city. There were contrasts of wealth and poverty, the culture of possession, the frantic advertising. There was the fierce economic competition in which the legal violence of the state and the legal robbery of the corporation led to the illegal crimes of the poor. Most crimes by far involved theft. In the year 1978, 50% of prisoners in American jails were black. 31% had been unemployed in the month prior to their arrest, and 60% had earned less than $6,000 in the year prior to their arrest. The most common and most publicized crimes have been the violent crimes of the young, the poor, a virtual terrorization in the big cities in which the desperate or drug-addicted attack and rob the middle class, or even their fellow poor. A society so stratified by wealth and education lends itself naturally to envy and class anger. The critical question in our time is whether the middle classes, so long led to believe that the solution for such crimes is more jails and more jail terms, may begin to see by the sheer uncontrollability of crime that the only prospect is an endless cycle of crime and punishment. They might then conclude that the physical security for a working person in the city can come only when everyone in the city is working, and that would require a transformation of national priorities, a change in the system. In the 70s, the fear of criminal assault was joined by an even greater fear. Deaths from cancer began to multiply, and medical researchers seemed helpless to find the cause. It began to be evident that more and more of these deaths were coming from an environment poisoned by military experimentation and industrial greed. The water people drank, the air they breathed, the particles of dust from over the buildings in which they worked, had been quietly contaminated over the years by a system so frantic for growth and profit that the safety and health of human beings had been ignored. A woman in the town of Globe, Arizona, stepped outside her bedroom door one morning in the summer of 1969 and was covered with spray mist from a Forest Service helicopter spraying pesticides in a nearby national forest. She began to investigate and found plants and fruit trees dying nearby and organized local people in a mock funeral procession carrying the dead plants to the forest supervisor's office. Later she wrote a book called Sue the Bastards. But there were limits to what lawsuits could do, what books could do, to poison sprays. In early 1977, she died of cancer, and doctors found herbicides in her body tissue. The problem of pesticides in the air, of asbestos in the buildings, of lead paint on walls, of plutonium in the earth, of industrial wastes in drinking water, is a problem beyond class, race, or sex. It could unite people of all classes and groups in fury against those few in the establishment who, in their demonic pursuit of more weapons, more profits, keep insisting, like the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, like the tobacco companies, like Hoover in 1932 and Lyndon Johnson in Vietnam War, that everything is all right. Technology was running wild, and one of its effects, more subtle than radiation poisoning, was fearsome in its own way. There was a growing dependence on computers to replace human thought. An MIT pioneer in computer building, Joseph Weizenbaum, sounded the alarm against the perversion in his own book, Computer Power and Human Reason. People were attributing too much wisdom, he said, to science, whose knowledge is not certain. They were giving frightening power to machines, replacing human judgment. The deification of computers was a rejection of direct experience, a replacement of human sensitivity by mechanical devices. What Weizenbaum described has effects on the whole human race, not just one social group. People of all kinds seeing this might join to reassert the importance of the living being. This scary technology, and more, has been adopted by the military. Modern war now means not only the indiscriminate killing of the enemy, civilians as well as soldiers, as in World War II, Korea, Vietnam, but the use of weapons that kill friend and foe alike. A tiny group of military planners can launch attacks that will destroy not only enemy populations, but their own. The people of the United States, the people of the Soviet Union, indeed, the population of the world, are at the mercy of a few leaders of the superpowers who may decide, for their own reasons of strategy, power, or pride, to start the chain of nuclear detonations, or may start it without even deciding. Small experiences of the recent past suggest larger horrors for the future. In 1976, a book named Friendly Fire told of a U.S. infantryman in Vietnam who was reported to have died on a non-combat mission. His parents, grief-stricken and puzzled, investigated. They found the government uncooperative, cold, anxious to minimize and obscure what had happened. What had happened was that their son was killed by friendly fire, a misdirected artillery shell. The parents turned from quiet residents of Black Hawk County, Iowa, to angry, active opponents of the Vietnam War. The war that was supposed to kill the enemy had killed their son. In another war, we may all be killed by friendly fire. During the military operations in Vietnam, 20,000 tons of herbicides were dropped by U.S. planes on 5 million acres of the Vietnamese countryside, destroying trees and crops. Among Vietnamese mothers in those areas, birth defects developed in unusual numbers. In 1978, a woman named Claude de Victor, working for the Veterans Administration Hospital in Chicago, began to see a pattern of disease and death among former helicopter pilots. Some told of birth defects in babies born to their wives. When she reported this, she was transferred to another job. But shortly after that, a one-paragraph item from Washington appeared on an inside page of the Boston Globe. The Veterans Administration warned its offices across the country yesterday to watch out for after-effects among veterans of the Vietnam defoliant Agent Orange, which some researchers suspect of possible links with cancer or genetic defects. Thousands of veterans were exposed to Orange, the most effective and heavily used of the various defoliation compounds, of which more than £100 million were sprayed over one-seventh of Vietnam's land area between 1962 and 1971. Perhaps much of the general distrust of government reported in recent years comes from a growing recognition of the truth of what the U.S. Air Force bombardier Yossarian said in the novel Catch-22 to a friend who had just accused him of giving aid and comfort to the enemy. "The enemy is anybody who's going to get you killed, no matter which side he's on, and don't you forget that, because the longer you remember it, the longer you might live." The next line in the novel is, "But Clevenger did forget, and now he was dead." In the late 70s, the American system seemed out of control. The runaway capitalism, a runaway technology, a runaway militarism, a runaway form of government from the people it claimed to represent. Crime was out of control, cancer was out of control, prices and taxes and unemployment were out of control, auto accidents, the decay of cities, and the breakup of families were out of control. The nuclear arms race was out of control, and people seemed to sense all this. Let us imagine the prospect, for the first time in the nation's history, of a population united for fundamental change. Would the elite turn, as so often before, to its ultimate weapon, foreign intervention, to unite the people with the establishment in war? Here, too, the situation may be different today. The defeat of the colossal U.S. military machine in Vietnam was a turning point. The American Empire may have reached its limits and must now retreat, recognizing that human beings abroad, if determined enough to rebel against harsh regimes, cannot be defeated, even with the most terrible of weapons. Ordinary weapons may not be enough, and nuclear weapons too much, to deal with popular revolutions, and Americans may no longer go along with military intervention. In the late 70s, there was growing evidence of U.S. impotence in the world arena. It could not stop, in 1979, a popular revolution in Iran, where in the past the CIA had had its way. And in the same year in Nicaragua, the very dynasty installed by U.S. Marines before World War II was toppled by a revolutionary army, and the U.S. government seemed unable to prevent this. With the establishment's inability either to solve severe economic problems at home or to manufacture abroad a safety valve for domestic discontent, Americans might be ready to demand not just more tinkering, more reform laws, another reshuffling of the same deck, another New Deal, but radical change. Let us be utopian for a moment, so that when we get realistic again, it is not that realism, so useful to the establishment, in its discouragement of action, that realism anchored to a certain kind of history empty of surprise. Let us imagine what radical change would require of us all. The society's levers of powers would have to be taken away from those whose drives have led to the present state, the giant corporations, the military, and their politician collaborators. We would need, by a coordinated effort of local groups all over the country, to reconstruct the economy for both efficiency and justice, producing in a cooperative way what people need most. We would start on our neighborhoods, our cities, our workplaces. Work of some kind would be needed by everyone, including people now kept out of the workforce, children, old people, handicapped people. Society could use the enormous energy now idle, the skills and talents now unused. Everyone could share the routine but necessary jobs for a few hours a day, and leave most of the time free for enjoyment, creativity, labors of love, and yet produce enough for an equal and ample distribution of goods. Certain basic things would be abundant enough to be taken out of the money system and be available free to everyone. Food, housing, health care, education, transportation. The great problem would be to work out a way of accomplishing this without a centralized bureaucracy, using not the incentives of prison and punishment, but those incentives of cooperation which spring from natural human desires, which in the past had been used by the state in times of war, but also by social movements that gave hints of how people might behave in different conditions. Decisions would be made by small groups of people in their workplaces, their neighborhoods, a network of cooperatives, in communication with one another, and neighborly socialism, avoiding the class hierarchies of capitalism and the harsh dictatorships that have taken the name socialist. People with time in friendly communities might create a new, diversified, non-violent culture in which all forms of personal and group expression would be possible. Men and women, black and white, old and young, could then cherish their differences as positive attributes, not as reasons for domination. New values of cooperation and freedom might then show up in the relations of people, the upbringing of children. To do all that in the complex conditions of control in the United States would require combining the energy of all previous movements in American history, of labor insurgents, black rebels, Native Americans, women, young people, along with the new energy of an angry middle class. People would need to begin to transform their immediate environments, the working place, the family, the school, the community, by a series of struggles against absentee authority, to give control of these places to the people who live and work there. These struggles would involve all the tactics used at various times in the past by people's movements: demonstrations, marches, civil disobedience, strikes and boycotts and general strikes, direct action to redistribute wealth, to reconstruct institutions, to revamp relationships, creating in music, literature, drama, all the arts, and all the areas of work and play in everyday life, a new culture of sharing, of respect, a new joy in the collaboration of people to help themselves and one another. There would be many defeats, but when such a movement took hold in hundreds of thousands of places all over the country, it would be impossible to suppress, because the very guards the system depends on to crush such a movement would be among the rebels. It would be a new kind of revolution, the only kind that could happen, I believe, in a country like the United States. It would take enormous energy, sacrifice, commitment, patience. But because it would be a process over time, starting without delay, there would be the immediate satisfactions that people have always found in the affectionate ties of groups striving together for a common goal. All this takes us far from American history, into the realm of imagination, but not totally removed from history. There are at least glimpses in the past of such a possibility. In the 60s and 70s, for the first time, the establishment failed to produce a national unity and patriotic fervor in a war. There was a flood of cultural changes such as the country had never seen, in sex, family, personal relations, exactly those situations most difficult to control from the ordinary centers of power. And never before was there such a general withdrawal of confidence from so many elements of the political and economic system. In every period of history, people have found ways to help one another, even in the midst of a culture of competition and violence, if only for brief periods, to find joy in work, struggle, companionship, nature. The prospect is for times of turmoil, struggle, but also inspiration. There's a chance that such a movement could succeed in doing what the system itself has never done: bring about a change with little violence. This is possible because the more of the 99% that begin to see themselves as sharing needs, the more the guards and the prisoners see their common interest, the more the establishment becomes isolated, ineffectual. The elite's weapons, money, control of information, would be useless in the face of a determined population. The servants of the system would refuse to work to continue the old deadly order, and would begin using their time, their space, the very things given to them by the system to keep them quiet, to dismantle that system while creating a new one. The prisoners of the system will continue to rebel, as before, in ways that cannot be foreseen, at times that cannot be predicted. The new fact of our era is the chance that they may be joined by the guards. We readers and writers of books have been, for the most part, among the guards. If we understand that and act on it, not only will life be more satisfying right off, but our grandchildren or our great-grandchildren might possibly see a different and marvelous world.
We'll always be filled.
This and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks to everybody who's been submitting material, especially to Matthew Slater, whose recording of Howard Zinn gave me the idea for this week's episode.